I'd like to call the meeting to order. This is the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. Tom Huntley is the chair, but today you have some stand-in chairs. Myself, Kim Norton, Jeff Hayden, and Nora Slawick here are at the head table, as well as other members of the committee. I want to apologize up front, way down the end of the table, too. Sorry, Representative Gotwell. We have conflicts this morning due to the lateness in the session, and so many people are going to be coming and going, and we don't have a full committee, but we did want to take some testimony on this issue yet this year, and I think Chair Huntley can talk later about some ideas he has and some provisions we put in the bill last night that might be of interest to the group here today. So I think perhaps without further ado, we should get into the program. The agendas, I think, have been handed out. And if not, there'll be some up at the table in just a moment. Mr. Chair, we do have a note for approval of past minutes, and would you like me to take care of that?
Okay. We can only do that if we have a quorum.
We don't have a quorum yet. Okay, so we'll skip the approval of the minutes, and if we get a quorum, someone can let us know, and we can move the minutes at a later time. So I have the first testifier is Judy Punkio, and I may be saying that incorrectly. And so she comes to the table and sets up. I believe there's a PowerPoint. I'm going to have the other co-chairs make a few opening comments. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I think that this is an important issue, and I'm glad that we are having this testimony. What we hope is that this is a conversation of many to come. And unfortunately, we don't have our full committee here, and there are lots going on, and so we apologize for not being able to give it our full attention. This issue of autism is something that is growing throughout our country with all of our children, but it has come to our attention that in the Somali community that there seems to be greater rates of autism in the Somali community, as well as there seem to be other issues relating to early diagnosis, early treatment, and effective treatment. And what we hope to do today is to not necessarily go over the bills that we've already passed and bills that are already on their way. We are very late in the session, but really to have a conversation about what are the challenges, what are the issues facing this community, and then we hope to continue to move forward with several kind of ideas so that as we look at this from a policy perspective next session, we really do have our ducks in a row and we can really do great work for our children and our community. Representative Salt.
Thank you. I want to thank Chair Huntley for having this today and for having a hearing on autism, specifically in the Somali community. I sit on the Joint Senate House Autism Task Force, and I just wanted to acknowledge a couple people who are here from the task force. The chair is Dawn Steigoff. I know she's here. If she wants to, she's walking, you want to raise your hand. And I know Idol is here, who has done a lot of work on this issue and a lot of work organizing, so if you want to raise your hand. And I don't, is there anybody else here from the task force? Anybody else that's involved? Specifically, we want to let you know we are meeting on a monthly basis, and hope that folks that are here at this meeting will also look at our meeting. We also have had a hearing on autism in the Somali community and found it to be very helpful. I think that as policymakers, this is something that's going to be on our radar screen for a long time. They're just the rate of diagnosis of autism, the fact that more kids than ever are having it, and that families are dealing with it and getting some consistency is really important.
Thank you, both of you, for your comments. I think we're going to start with our testimony, and it looks like we have someone from the Department of Health at the table. And did you need help with the PowerPoint, or did you just like us to use the handouts and look at those? Is that acceptable?
I think we could start with the handout. So if the PowerPoint comes, we can work with that too.
All right. If you could just say your name for the tape and give your testimony.
My name is Judy Punko. I'm an epidemiologist with the Minnesota Department of Health Division of Community and Family Health in the Data Epidemiology Unit. I'm here to provide testimony on the report that the Minnesota Department of Health developed in response to Somali concerns about autism in their community. And the next slide shows an outline. I'm going to go through it rather briefly. Let's skip the ASD background because I think many of us have some clinicians in the audience who can help with questions regarding that. And we'll start out. The Minnesota Department of Health was alerted to reports of elevated ASD occurrence among Somali children attending Minneapolis Public Early Childhood Special Education, that's ECSE preschool programs for ASD. We found these reports concerning, but we didn't have enough information to really understand the situation. We had some questions. Was the elevation due to open enrollment with children from other school districts coming into Minneapolis? Did all of the children have ASD that were in the program? And how many children with ASD were not participating in Minneapolis Public Schools programs? Children between the ages of 3 and 4 are not required to go to school, and so it was a question we wondered about. So our overall goal in this study on the next slide was to estimate administrative prevalence, and we wanted to do this, get an estimate overall for all children, and then get estimates for each race, ethnicity categories the Minneapolis Public Schools had in their data, as well as by primary language spoken in the home, which would serve as a proxy for Somali descent versus non-Somali descent. Now, prevalence is estimated as the number of cases with a condition that occur in a defined population and a time period, and you divide that by the estimated size of the population in that time period. And so factors that would define a population include time period, geographic region, and characteristics like age. And I bring this up because it's important when you're comparing rates, you need to make sure that your rates are comparable by those characteristics.
We have a question before you go on, Representative Root.
Thank you, Manager. Could you just repeat that slowly one more time?
Okay, thank you.
Definition of prevalence.
Okay, prevalence is a measure of the occurrence of a condition in a population. It answers the question, who in a population has a condition? In order to understand the who part, we need to determine who those people are. And so in our analysis, we used children ages 3 and 4, and we defined the time period as being school years 2005-06, 2006-07, and 2007-08. We defined those time periods based on the data available from the Minneapolis Public Schools. Okay, so our counts to estimate administrative prevalence were obtained from the Minneapolis Public Schools Special Education Program, and these counts represented the number of children receiving ECSE services from the Minneapolis Public Schools during that time period. It's important to point out that does not reflect necessarily all children who truly have ASD. Our denominator for the prevalence estimate, which was the defined population, was obtained from birth certificate data because we didn't have current population census data available that would give us accurate numbers. Now, there were some challenges in this analysis, in conducting this analysis using administrative data for public health purposes. One problem, as I mentioned, was that we had to use a proxy to identify the Somali descent by using primary language spoken in a home. In the birth certificate data set, we were able to use the mother's country of origin, so we had a match there. A bigger problem was that in defining our population, we defined the population based on mother's residency at the time of her child's birth, and that would be the city of Minneapolis. Minneapolis Public Schools data did not have that data available, and so what we had to do was develop a series of analytic assumptions that would give us a range from the lowest estimate to the highest estimate, and we used those estimates to sort of evaluate the robustness of the patterns we saw in the data. So if we saw consistent patterns, we would be reassured that there was something going on that was reliable. If they were inconsistent, then we'd have some concerns and maybe say the data weren't good enough to answer the question. So I'm going on now to summarizing the major findings. So we estimated administrative prevalence overall for three school years, and we did find, in fact, that the increases, as people have reported this morning, were consistent. The participation in school programs increased every year. These results were reassuring to us because they are consistent with national trends. If we had found something different, we might have been a little concerned about the data. Secondly, we found that administrative prevalence for Somali-speaking children was significantly greater than that for non-Somali-speaking children. This pattern was consistent across most analytic assumptions, school years, and ASD program types. This importantly confirmed what families and others had observed, that there were larger proportions of Somali children participating in these programs. But because of the limitations of the data itself, we didn't know if the Somalis had a higher true population prevalence of ASD. We couldn't answer that question with the data. For instance, we were asking questions like, was there more effective outreach for early intervention in Somali communities compared with some non-Somali communities? Were there more non-Somali children accessing services outside of the school system for any variety of reasons? Another thing we found was that the administrative prevalence for Somali children ages 3 and 4 for the year 2005-06 was not statistically different from an estimate we obtained from the National Survey of Children with Special Health Needs that was based on parental report. Now, these data are limited because they're based on parental report, but it's the only data we had that we could use to compare and find out, well, what's the baseline here? So the question we asked was the difference we found between non-Somali and Somali administrative prevalence estimates driven by substantial underparticipation in the Minneapolis programs by children whose families did not speak Somali as the primary language in their home? Finally, we found that the difference in the administrative prevalence estimates between the Somali families or speaking children and the non-Somali children decreased fairly rapidly over time. Such changes are not typical in prevalence of chronic diseases. We don't normally see changes that quickly. So some questions were raised. It was, well, are more non-Somali families bringing their children in for services in the Minneapolis public schools? We were identifying Somali descent based on primary languages spoken in the home, we started wondering, well, are many more Somali families now reporting that they're speaking English as the primary language in the home? And so we're seeing those prevalence estimates for non-Somali families going up because we were misclassifying Somalis as non-Somalis. The third major finding was that we found strikingly low administrative prevalence, that is, service use in the Minneapolis public schools among Asian and Native American children. So again, the question was raised, was outreach in these communities not as effective? Were Asian and Native American families seeking services outside of the public school system? We are aware that there are traditional healers and shaman that may be via providing services. Or was it because the population sizes were so small among these groups that the prevalence would just simply be low? Again, we didn't have any answers for these questions. Well, these questions generated a set of three next steps that we are currently working on. And I'll take it from the chairs to give me some guidance on how long you want me to go, because I know we're a little stretched for time. And I'll go, and then if you want me to stop, I'll be happy to. The first priority we had was to confirm the ASD diagnoses of the children who were participating in these programs during those school years. We wanted to also understand the profile or status of these children because there were reports that Somali children appeared to need more intensive intervention than other children. Secondly, we wanted to understand the role of culture in the identification of ASD and other developmental disabilities and how cultural influences parental help-seeking behaviors. To this end, we needed to learn more about the system and how it identified children in need of early intervention. We were asking questions about outreach efforts. Were there alternative programs? We wanted to learn about those. We wanted to know where other sources of service were. Families near the suburbs of Minneapolis may be crossing the border and receiving services outside of Minneapolis, for instance. or they may be seeking private services if they can pay out of pocket for those. Thirdly, we ask the question, well, what can we do to better estimate prevalence of autism in the state? And so we wanted to learn more about what methods and approaches were needed to accurately estimate population prevalence in Minnesota. So what would it take for Minnesota to develop a public health surveillance system for ASD? Okay, the next set of slides just briefly sort of summarizes our work to date. We established, to learn more about the diagnoses of the children participating in the programs, we established a clinician's work group. The charge of this group was to develop a uniform diagnostic protocol that could be used to confirm the diagnoses of ASD in children that were included in the MDH study. The membership of this group was quite broad. It included Minneapolis Public Schools, Minnesota Department of Education, Minnesota Department of Health staff. It also included physicians. We had physicians from Minneapolis Children's, Park Nicollet, and the University of Minnesota. We had two Somali physicians on the group. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they had representatives from the Developmental Disabilities Branch. And we had a Somali mother and advocate who later joined us. Our progress was achieved through conference calls. We had two subgroups. One was an epidemiology subgroup that dealt with scientific questions. The other related to study design and sampling. The other group was a clinician subgroup that established the protocol. We have established a protocol. It identifies instruments that need to be used to confirm the ASD diagnoses. It specifies clinician qualifications, interpreter qualifications, and quality assurance checks. We are currently partnering with the University of Minnesota Autism Clinics to develop a protocol that will validate the diagnostic protocol and confirm the ASD diagnoses, and we hope to submit a grant application to the National Institutes of Health to try to do that. Second, an analytic work is related to a cultural influences work group, which was established, the charge of this group was to understand the role of culture in the identification of developmental problems and help-seeking behaviors. The membership on this group, again, was broad. We had a Somali mother and advocate. We had Minneapolis Public Schools, Minnesota Department of Education, Department of Human Services, Minnesota Department of Health. We had the president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We had St. Cloud State University, a speech-language pathologist. We had a professor of anthropology and human sciences from George Washington University. We had representatives from the PACER and other researchers, and including an American Indian researcher who's got some work done in their community. Before we got started, the health department felt we needed to better understand what was going on. So we conducted a literature review to find out what the literature said about culture and the perception of disease, especially around autism. And what did culture say? Well, how did culture influence help-seeking behaviors? And so we wanted to just know what had previously been determined in the literature. We also conducted some informal key informant interviews, and we interviewed community advocates, medical personnel, people in education and government to get their read on, well, what did you think about this? What was your experience? What were families saying to you? These efforts yielded information both from the public literature and anecdote that did confirm that culture can play a role in the identification of autism in a clinical sense, in a parental sense of a parent identifying a trigger or a problem in development, and also in what services, when and what services would families seek. These efforts also helped us identify who in the broader community might be able to help us develop and organize a plan for action. On the next slide, we show just a little bit of progress here. We convened a conference call at the end of January of this broad group of stakeholders. Our participants were energized and engaged, and they shared experiences, and they did confirm that there was a need for further research in this area. We found that the conference call was not really an effective way to organize or develop a protocol over the phone. So we determined that we needed to develop a set of analytic questions that would gather the information that the Minnesota Department of Health needed to answer questions stemming from the report, as well as organize the information we'd gathered into some sort of a draft protocol that we could then bring out and get feedback on. In the process of doing this, we realized that we had some limitations in qualitative analysis, and we've been partnering with the University of Minnesota and others to help us build the capacity to seek funding and achieve funding for this problem. Finally, we are investigating the feasibility of establishing a public health surveillance system in Minnesota. I think we're maybe running out of time here, and so I will just leave it at that. We are investigating the feasibility through looking at school districts, data sources, medical and other provider data sources, and trying to build relationships so that we can provide information for policymakers.
Thank you very much. I wanted just some clarification on, and we have three questions that I'm aware of right now. Primarily, your work started through the Minneapolis Public Schools. Have you branched out beyond that to other schools that have higher Somali populations, or have you primarily stayed in the Minneapolis area?
To answer the question, we stuck with the Minneapolis Public Schools. In our work now, we are looking at trying to estimate administrative prevalence for a larger region like Hennepin County, and that work is ongoing.
Okay, and I would say I've been in contact in the last couple weeks with Dr. Shire, who is maybe going to be here today. He is here, who is interested in pursuing some of this information, and I would encourage perhaps the two of you to connect because I think he has some interesting thoughts and ideas and is interested in pursuing an NIH grant as well, and maybe you can update him as to where you're at with that process and if there's a role he could play in helping. He has some ideas that I think are worth listening to, so I'd encourage that contact. I had Representative Kiffmeyer, Representative Rood, and Representative Gottwalt that had questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question pertains to the slide that has to do with your main findings summary. And I have actually a few questions here. One of them, it says the 0506 AP for Somali children was not statistically different from U.S. parental reported prevalence. Could you explain that a little bit more? Because it seems to contradict what we're kind of talking about here.
Well, yes, Madam Chair, Representative.
Dr. Punkio.
Thank you. Because Minnesota doesn't have a population-based surveillance system, we don't know what the baseline rates for autism are. If we're going to compare autism among Somali children with non-Somali children in the Minneapolis public schools, it gives us a very narrow view of differences. We thought that perhaps we could get an additional perspective on what might be happening if we used the parental reported prevalence. So basically, this data was collected by randomly sampling parents in the United States and asking them, are you aware, or have you ever been told that your child has autism or autism spectrum disorder? The quality of the information is different than what you would get from educational records, but it's all we had. It does seem to contradict it, but again, the data may not be completely comparable, and it just raises questions rather than gives us a definitive answer on what the situation is.
Madam Chair. I have another question.
You may proceed.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, and I do understand that, especially in early statistical studies, there are indicators sometimes, and that's the whole point is to, enough of an indicator to check into it further. But the assumptions, the underlying assumptions, are always very, very important. And the accuracy of the data that feed into those assumptions are really, really important. One other area that I also wondered if there had been any connections, and in this particular population is relatively new to the United States and possibly to Minnesota as well. And there was information recently about the possible connection with vaccinations and autism, and wondering if that is on your radar screen at all as an epidemiologist as well.
Doctor? And would you do me the favor of pronouncing your last name for me so I can do it correctly?
Punkel.
Punkel. Thank you very much. Dr. Punkel.
Madam Chair, Representative, I prepared a presentation on the MDH report. In this report, we wanted to understand prevalence and the situation as it was occurring in Minneapolis in response to community concerns. We did not attempt to look at risk factors or reasons or causes for the occurrence of autism in the community.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. I think it is important, and I understand, and so you're mainly taking a look at just statistically if this indeed is a situation, but not causal necessarily. But I think if you're doing the process of gathering data, sometimes, you know, as long as you're doing it, that may be something, especially in this particular case. So the other thing is,
Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm just going to ask you to move along and stick with the topic of the Somali incidents in the Somali community and the issues we've been discussing, because we have a dozen testifiers and only 30, how many minutes to go?
Yeah.
And so we just pick up the pace a tiny bit for me. I'd appreciate it. And then we want to get to the two other questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that very much. Thank you. The other thing is that clinician work group, a uniform diagnostic protocol, is that already developed? Or I came in a little bit late. I've got two committees. I'm sorry, so I just wasn't able to catch the whole beginning. Is that already available to that diagnostic protocol? Isn't that already in?
Doctor?
Madam Chair, yes, we have developed a uniform diagnostic protocol within this work group, and we are hoping to implement it.
Okay.
And I'm going to move along, but first, we do have a quorum, so I'd like to approve the minutes. Do I have someone? Oh, and I have to officially call the meeting to order. And now we will ask, Representative Rood has moved the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Representative Rood, it's now your turn for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Punkel, I'm not aware of other parts of the United States that has as large a population of the Somali community. But I'm wondering, I'm assuming they exist and certainly probably exist in other parts of the world. Are you aware, what we are investigating here, has this been brought up in other parts of the world as well, or the country or well, that people seem to be seeing an increase in autism diagnosis in the Somali community in places other than Minnesota?
Dr. Punkel.
Madam Chair. I am aware of one other research study that was conducted in Sweden. It was published in August of 2008. They did report an elevation of ASD among Somali children compared to other children. That study, I believe, suffered from some of the other major limitations that our study suffered from, and that there may be some potential for some selection bias, if you will, so maybe some bias comparisons. I think work is going on, continuing to go on, but I'm not aware of the findings of that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Gottwalt, and then we'll move on to our next testifiers.
Quickly, Madam Chair, I appreciate the presentation. I was frankly alarmed and shocked at the prevalence. All of you are looking at the sheet that I'm looking at. It's pretty extraordinary. And I was hoping to get more information about cause, but I understand you're here mainly reporting on prevalence. I also appreciated the comment about extending this to schools outside the Twin Cities. We have a very strong concentration of Somali immigrants in my district up in St. Mm-hmm. Cloud, mm-hmm. and would hope that they could be included in this study as well. But I'm very interested in the cause and how we can get at it.
Thank you, Representative Gottwalt, and I think that's a concern to all of us at the table here, and that's one of the reasons we're bringing folks together, so we can raise the interest and highlight this issue and address that, hopefully, in the very near future. Doctor, did you have any closing comments, and we'll move on with the next testifiers?
No, but thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for being here. If I could ask Gary Cox and Heidi Hamilton. Gary Cox is with the Department of Human Services, and Heidi Hamilton is with the Department of Human Services as well. Well, And I think we're going to have to try to keep it to about 5 minutes so that we can have our other testifiers move through to a couple minutes each, and I think we can do this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That'll take care of my 15-minute speech then.
Don't breathe. Just start talking.
We were. I'm Gary Cox with the Children's Mental Health Division, Department of Human Services, and the department was asked to present some information on the services that are provided to children with autism, and specifically, what does MA pay for children with autism? I've handed out, I hope you all have it, a very complicated sheet that looks like this. It's got lots of boxes, and it's entitled All Health Procedures for Children 0 to 18 with an Autism Spectrum Diagnosis. What we've done here is we went into the Medicaid management system and identified, and we looked at children for this report, children with the primary diagnosis of on the autism spectrum, and then asked the system to tell us what services were provided to those children. So you can see I've provided you with 6 pages of a 31-page report. It sort of goes down from the, it starts with the highest number of claims and more or less goes down from there. What you'll see is that the most prevalent system or most prevalent claim is personal care assistance or personal care services or PCA services, which probably wouldn't surprise you. The second most frequent claim reported is skills training and development, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. The skills training from the point of view of the public mental health system is largely the what we call the CTSS services, the skills training in CTSS. But there are other things that are provided in the private sector that are comparable to that. So you can just look down the list and pick one that you're interested in. And what the chart does is, if you look at the third column in, it's the unduplicated number of children that received this service. And that's under the fee-for-service side. And then if you go over, there's another group of columns under the label of PMAP, which is the managed care side, and you'll see another column of unduplicated number of children with the same service. So you can compare side by side the number of claims in the fee-for-service MA and the managed care MA.
And Mr. Cox, could you, one of the issues that comes up often is there supposed to be an equity across all services that the states provide? If you provide a service for under the fee-for-service, you should also provide that as a prepaid and in the state plans, and is that the case?
It's more or less the same. There are some differences. When the department contracts with the health plans for to provide the medical assistance benefit, they're responsible for providing that entire benefit. But there are some differences. There's a primary difference in, like you'll see down in this list, there's some the common community-based waivers, which are almost always, I think, always on the fee-for-service side. Managed care plans don't get into that. And then I think that's the primary difference. Anybody want to correct that?
Thank you for the clarification.
You know, you can look at these numbers and all these things, and you see that medical assistance does provide a great number of services to children with autism. There are mental health services, there are home and community-based services, home care services, medical services. What this tells you is that children with autism are extremely complex, that they have a great deal of needs. It's not just in the mental health area. It's not just in the behavioral health area. There are a lot of different needs.
Mr. Cox, can I ask one other question? How do you determine when a service leaves the healthcare arena and enters the education arena? Because we know for children with autism, often those services overlap. Schools are providing many of the same services. that we might consider mental health or health-related, and yet that isn't necessarily the case isn't necessarily reversed, that the healthcare area would pay for education services. Do you have a hard and fast rule on that? Or?
Well, the legislature enacted a law several years ago that requires medical assistance to pay for mental health services provided to children in schools. Well, it's services provided to children with the individual education plan or IEP. Mm-hmm. Their payment rate is quite a bit different, and they can choose which services to provide or not. So you'll see great differences among school districts on what they choose to provide and who they choose to provide it to. That's really up to the school district. But once they decide to provide it, then they have to submit billings to the state. It's not in the same manner. They get paid in a different way, but they choose the services that they provide.
Thank you, Representative Slawik.
Thank you. I have a question. It seems like part of the controversy and what we're trying to sort out here is making sure all kids are treated equal. And what I'm having some trouble figuring out is for ABA, would that be categorized under skills and training and development? Or are kids on MA eligible for ABA services, or how does that work?
That's complex. Can I have? I'm prepared to walk you through that, but can I do that in a way that
I think we'd like to have you do that? Okay. Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Okay.
So let's back up a little bit. Federal Medicaid payment is based on medical procedures. It requires states to pay for procedures or services. Sometimes they're called. It does not allow states to pay for bundles of services or packages of service or models of service delivery. For example, a heart bypass is a procedure. A blood test is a procedure. Psychotherapy is a procedure. Training a child in a skill that will allow him to speak or to make friends is a procedure. When you talk about applied behavioral analysis, that's not a procedure. It is a bundle of procedures or a particular model of or manner of delivering a set of procedures. Excuse me for using a sports analogy. They're annoying, but sometimes useful. Medicaid pays for running. It pays for catching a ball. It pays for throwing a ball. It pays for hitting a ball with a big stick. But it does not pay for baseball. It does not pay for soccer. It does not pay for football. It doesn't matter if one player runs around in a square pattern, touching a bag of sand on the ground, and another player runs straight down the field toward an upright post with a cross member. It pays for running. It's up to the players to put these procedures together in a way that allows them to win a game, and that's pretty much the same kind of comparison you can make between medical procedures and comparing a model like ABA or in the public side CTSS or Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports.
And so, Mr. Cox says Dr. Huntley received a letter from a provider saying they provide ABA services. It's a center-based program, but it's billed under individual skills training, speech therapy, occupational therapy. So that's the analogy you're drawing, is that the different services are billed, but it's called ABA to the provider, or to perhaps even that might be what the parent hears.
Right. The way it works is medical assistance does not pay for ABA, but it pays for some components that are used by providers of ABA services.
Thank you. I think that clarifies for some of us some confusion we've been hearing.
Okay.
And yes, Representative Payton has a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cox. So just to kind of extend that, because I want this to be clear, this was a point of contention when we had the hearing on the insurance mandate question. I'm trying to figure out how to say it. Are there things that we're asking the plans to do that is different than what MA pays for? I understand your analogy of that you kind of take the procedures, but are there additional procedures that we're asking the plans to be responsible for that MA wouldn't pay for? Does that
there probably are differences between MA and the health plans on the private sector, but they are, but the health plans with which the department contracts to deliver the medical assistance benefit, they're required to provide the same benefit set. Now, the way they do that can be different, and that will differ between fee-for-service and health plan, and it will also differ among health plans. But the basic requirement to provide the benefit set is the same.
Good, thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you want to finish up, and then we want Heidi to go as well.
I guess just to finish up on this this issue here is we sometimes wonder if it makes sense to argue that you ought to pay for the package model when you're already getting paid for a set of procedures. As you can see from this list we handed out, MA pays for millions of dollars a year of skill training, psychotherapy, transportation, all kinds of other things. So it occurs to us that the procedures covered by medical assistance must comprise a bulk of the components that are used in the ABA model. I guess that's all I need to say on that. Heidi also has... you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Sure, hi. My name is Heidi Hamilton with the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. I've provided a handout called Services for Individuals with Autism, and this just provides a summary of the services that are may be available to individuals with autism. These are services available through our home and community-based waiver programs, through medical assistance home care, through mental health services. And so individuals would need to qualify for those programs in order to access these services, but this is just a description of the services that may be available to individuals with autism.
Thank you.
Madam
so
Chair,
much.
There's one other point that I should probably make. As the members of the committee that have been around for quite a while probably remember that the legislature enacted a benefit that in 2003 that was called Intensive Early Intervention Behavior Therapy Services. It was based on the ABA model, was for all intents and purposes, it was ABA. It was enacted in 2003. The legislature, or the department then submitted a state Medicaid plan amendment to the federal government, and it took a while, but it came back. It was denied, and then in 2007 the legislature repealed that benefit without ever having been enacted. So the point is that the attempt to pay for bundled services has been made in the state of Minnesota and was denied by the Fed, so we continue to pay for the component pieces of it.
And I really appreciate that. That's been very confusing for a lot of us, I think in the audience as well as here at the table over time, and kind of flies in the face of what we're doing with healthcare reform as a whole, which is moving toward a bundled services model. So I know the federal government is dealing with this in their healthcare reform discussions, and in fact some of this is in rulemaking right now at the federal level, and perhaps Representative Huntley is representing Minnesota will want to weigh in on that with our local congressman to see that this discussion happens at the federal level as well, because it's a very important point. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, the example I always use about the fee-for-service system, it's like if you paid a professional basketball team for shots made rather than shots, paid for shots taken rather than paying for shots made, you'd have an entirely different game.
You would indeed. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. I'm just wondering, under ABA, so is there a defined set of items that that people can know that is ABA, that you there's a list of 10 things and that equals ABA?
Mr.
Or is
Cox.
That a moving target?
Madam Chair, Representative Root, I wish I knew that question. You're going to have to ask an ABA provider that. That's a question that I've been asking for at least 2 years now. In my mind, it comes down, what I want to know is, what does a child get with ABA that they do not get with CTSS or the MA benefit set? And I haven't been able to get an answer to that yet. It appears to us that providers who call themselves ABA providers they're submitting a lot of billings, and they continue to be doing business So it must be paying for at least a substantial portion of the work they do, but I don't really know the difference.
And I think, Representative Rood, perhaps that's something we can put on the list of topics in the interim to study, because we do have contact now with a number of providers, and we could have some of them come forward and define that, and I have in my office a file of research quite deep, actually, at this point, that I'll get through yet again this summer, and I think that's an excellent topic for the future. I do want to thank both of you for being here. We do have a list of, looks like, some folks from the University of Minnesota, as well as Dr. Shire from Mayo Clinic, but before we get to that, we have a whole number of parents who have come to share their stories, and so thank you very much for being here, and I think we'd like to call the parents up, community members, perhaps two at a time, and if you could keep your remarks short, so we can get through everyone, because I think you all have stories that you want to share and that are important for this committee to hear. So, Abdul Diria, Abdi Hassan, and then for those of you that want to know who's next, there's an agenda up there. It looks like Abdullah Farah and Noor Hale or Holly. And I apologize for the names.
That's okay. There'll be a test after this to spell the Somali names. We have a couple of parents. They both have two kids with autism, but we also have Anne Harrington, who's been sort of like a, we gave her Somali citizenship because she's been the person telling the story about Somalis from school. So
I've added her to the list.
Right. So she's going to come with them.
About a couple minutes each is, if you can do that, just very short.
Sure. Hello. My name is Abdul Diria.
Thank you.
I have two kids with autism, a 5-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. My daughter was diagnosed with autism a couple months ago. What I want to testify mainly is my son was nonverbal completely till age 3 and a half. And now he started to talk and to do some life skills. And this was with the help of ABA, mainly. My daughter also is getting ABA. So if, still I didn't understand because the way it was explained, whether ABA and the stock and this, to me it is one thing. ABA helped my son. I'm not a professional to know what ABA is, but what I know is my son was nonverbal completely. He became verbal. He's going to a kindergarten, and I'm working very hard with him to make him a productive citizen. So instead of being the side of help receiver, to become a normal kid, to go to school, to have life, to have professional like everybody. So help us to help our kids. The second part which I want to talk about is the autism issue in the Somali community is huge. Probably Department of DHS, they got a sample from the area of the Minneapolis school district. But myself as an advocate, because most of the people which I contact in the Somali American community, they don't speak English. Most of them are single women, single moms with four. I came across families with 4 and 5 kids with autism. So if they go around the Twin Cities on the special ed classes, they will find out in each school district within the Twin Cities, they will find a kid or two with a Somali origin. So the issue is very big. Just help us to help ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could I ask you a quick question about diagnosis? Can you tell me how your child was diagnosed?
Well, the diagnosis, this is another topic because I did not want to take time of others, but it's a mess. Really, the whole diagnosis which we got was from school, and till today, my son, even though he was diagnosed through the school about 3 years ago, we don't have an official medical diagnosis. We were in waiting list for a long time.
So it was through an early childhood program at the school?
Early childhood program, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, I don't know if this is the right place to do it, but one of the questions I had, and I know it was kind of central to kind of the nexus of this hearing, is the coverage issue with DHS and the public programs. I apologize, I had to step out for a meeting, but has that question been raised? And if not, could I raise it with the DHS people? I don't want to get in the way of other testifiers.
Well, Representative Gowell, we did discuss that early on, and I'm going to ask that we let the parents testify first, and then we can get back to that at the end, if you don't mind. We do have the University of Minnesota that'll be up here, and perhaps they can address it. And DHS is in the audience over there if you want to run over. And if somebody over there, where'd they go? Yeah. They'd wave. They're over there. Yeah. There's a couple. So you could sneak over there and ask a question, but I don't want to take the time away from the parents right now, if you don't mind. Thank you. Abdi Hakim Hassan is next on the list.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting, I would just point out, I think there are a number of people here who want to hear the answer to that question, too, so it might be good to...
We just talked about it, so I hate to go back over it. All these people were in the room, and I'd rather you go...
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes.
Representative Gawa, the department did answer the question. I think in the short of it was that they are requiring it was a baseball analogy. In other words, they don't pay for bundled services. They don't pay for baseball, but they do pay for running to the base and hitting the ball. And so that's why it's a complex answer that I think we want you to talk to the department. But they're,
And Gary Cox is right over there in the tan jacket waving, and if you go talk to him, I think he'd love to talk the baseball analogy one more time through for you. At the table?
I do have one question on the
okay. Representative Hayden.
Can I just ask who pays for your ABA services? Is it your insurance or is it MA? Can you help us to know how... Who helps to provide or who helps to pay for the services that your child gets?
Right now it is MA, but I don't know down the road the way it is said or the analogy. We are in a limbo. We don't know if it's going to be paid in the future or not, but right now we are getting it through MA.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Apparently, I'm being given the microphone from my Somali colleagues, and I'm very moved and honored to be here to speak on their behalf. My name is Anne Harrington, and I worked in Minneapolis School's Early Childhood Special Education Program for over 22 years, and the last 8 of those, I was the coordinator of the Early Childhood Special Education Autism Program. And I've been actually following the data of children coming into the Minneapolis School's Early Childhood Special Education Program for over 25 years. And as the coordinator had to collect specific data, I should have spoken right after Judy Punkio, actually, because I'd like to put a face to the numbers that she's speaking about. One of the reasons why I moved on from the Minneapolis schools was to try to expand proven and cost-effective service options for all children and families with autism, because there is such a need both for early identification, evaluation from the medical perspective. Many of our families are on waiting lists with a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old child, and they're being told they need to wait for sometimes up to a year and a half, not only for an evaluation, but for services. So there's a huge need for all of our children on the autism spectrum to expand appropriate medical assessment as well as the continuing with the educational system. So that's a piece that I think we really need to look at as legislators. As I was working in Minneapolis schools in the ECSE program, I was seeing as the Somali immigrants moved to our community, I was seeing a steadily increasing number of Somali children with classic characteristics of autism. And I think there's been a question as to whether or not they were appropriately identified by the school system. And I will have to say, from my personal perspective, any of you who know children on the autism spectrum would have recognized that these Somali children have autism. We are sorely needing a consistent identification process and surveillance system, both from the educational community and the medical community, and more collaboration across both of those communities as we are working with the same population.
Ms. Harrington, can I ask you a question? You were with Minneapolis schools, and it seems like we do have some issues that are going to be perhaps Minneapolis, and I would love to know if this issue, I don't think this is the case down in Rochester, so I'm wondering if this is a statewide issue or if it's primarily in the Twin Cities or the suburbs have the same issue, so that we know as we move forward how to address it.
Thank you for asking that question. When I was aware of the data that I was seeing, and thank you to the health department for taking this issue seriously and going forward and validating the numbers that I was seeing, 25% of the children that were needing the intensive services in the Minneapolis schools early childhood special ed program were Somali children, and that was disproportionate to the numbers that I was seeing of other children with autism in the Minneapolis schools. So I'm sort of a lay public health professional, I guess, and I called Rochester because I know that there's a high incidence mm-hmm. of autism in the, or I'm sorry, there's a high number of Somalis in the Rochester and St. Cloud communities. And this is where it gets back to data collection and surveillance. Minneapolis schools happens to be an excellent program for evaluation of children on the autism spectrum. And we feel it's a responsibility to identify them early mm-hmm. and to name autism when we see it. Other school districts that may have fewer resources or may be struggling with, you know, is it a cultural issue versus not? So I called Rochester knowing that they have a high Somali population, and I was told that they had no children in early childhood special education on the autism spectrum at that time. This was a couple of years ago. However, they also indicated to me that they tend not to identify them until they enter kindergarten and would prefer to bring them in under what educationally we can call the developmental disability category from an educational perspective. So this is, again, where we need to collaborate between education and the medical community. I got the same response in St. Cloud. And so I think sometimes when you see high incidence in Minneapolis, it does not mean that there is not a high incidence in...
It's just identified differently.
It's identified differently.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up. We have these parents that have come. I'd
yes.
to hear them.
So my main message is that the need is incredibly great, and for children, all children on the autism spectrum, for expanded proven treatment options and for coverage, both privately and publicly funded treatment services. The families that I've worked with that are Somali on the autism spectrum, and I provide many of my services for free because these families cannot pay out of pocket, and many insurance companies, including MA, will not pay for it. But
Thank
working with
much.
Families who have parents sleeping in front of the door so that they can prevent their Somali child with autism from escaping because they don't know how to work with these children, or families that are losing their apartments because the child with autism is destroying the building that they're living in and they have to move from place to place. So it's critical that we get treatment options that provide this to all of our families.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your story. And I know there some of these folks have had the hearing on the Lifesaver initiative that Representative Welty carried, which links very nicely with the story that you just told. Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair and Ms. Harrington, if you could come. At what age do they get into the early childhood in the school system?
Early childhood special education starts children from birth to kindergarten.
Okay.
Yeah, Minnesota is considered a birth state with regard to special education. All states aren't. We're very fortunate that we've continued to support that and have federal funds as well. And if you would say your name for the record.
My name is Abdi Hakeem Hassan.
Thank you.
I do have two sons who are affected by autism. One is 12 years old, and the other one is 9 years old. I would like to start a question, and I'll ask that question later. I have two sons. The other one is mild, and the other one is high-functioning autism. When I say mild, it means he talks, he do his own things. But the other one is nonverbal. He's 9 years old. He doesn't talk. He doesn't say a word. And he doesn't know. You don't know what he wants and what he doesn't want. My two sons, they've been in the public school since they've been diagnosed that they have autism. And I don't think they benefit anything from the from the public school. It's just like I will offend some people, but I could say it's just like daycare.
Mr. Hassan, could you tell me how old your child was when they were diagnosed?
One 12 years old and the other one is 9 years old.
And at what age were they diagnosed?
They've been diagnosed since they've been like 3 years old.
3 years old.
And they've been in the public school since then.
Thank you.
I don't have enough time. That if I want to talk about this kind of spectrum, it takes like over 8 to 7 hours with my broken English. But I would like to summarize that my two sons, one, I try to find out whether they're gaining anything from the public school or the services that they're getting from the public school. I couldn't mention anything that they gained from the public school, except they keep my two sons in the school, so I can just feel relief when they are away from home. That is a place that I visited one about the last year, which they do ABA, and when I have seen and how they just deal with the kids and how they teaching the kids, it's absolutely amazing to me. And I said, I wish I know this kind of services, so I can put my two boys in here, so they can benefit as the benefit that the other kids are getting now. But they are now too old. One of them is 9 and the other one is 12. Sometimes I tell my mind, I say, oh, they cannot benefit anything from here. But when I have seen it, there is a kid that's 9 years, 12 years old, or over than 12, and means older than 12 years old, that they are benefiting from this kind of ABA. So they offer me that they will take my two sons as ABA for the ABA center. But I was told that the ABA was not been and ABA the MA won't be for an ABA. So I would like to ask the question that I would like to ask is, my kid has ABA now. They set it up for ABA. They came to my house and they analyzed my kid if they are qualified for ABA, and they say they are qualified, both of them. And I do have. They have the center. They've been provided this. They will be started the center for the next month, or during this month. So I would like to ask the M and DHS or MA. Did MA will pay this kind of ABA, or it's only been designed for this kind of services for the private insurance? That's the question that I would like to ask.
Actually, I think we had the question answered, and Mr. Cox isn't here any longer. That medical assistance does cover individual skills therapy and personal care attendance, as well as a very large list of other services. Private insurance companies, some of them cover it and some of them don't at this point. Mr. Cox, we have a question of a gentleman with a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old that an AB, I hate to put you on the spot here, but I'll just, I am going to. No. He has a 9 and a 12-year-old who have been enrolled in an ABA treatment, and he is being told that MA doesn't cover it, and so he's asking the question as to whether they would. And I said that they cover individual skills therapy and PCA because you weren't in the room, and I'm wondering if you can expound on that or if you would like to talk to him offline and answer that question for him. Scoot back at the mic. Yeah.
This one doesn't work. All right.
Oh, no, does it? The table, the test fire table. And if you'd state your name for the record again, I'm sorry. If you could just, I think, reiterate what you
okay.
stated earlier.
My name is Gary Cox with the Department of Human Services, Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think. I'd have to look at the specific situation, but I think if the provider would submit bills for CTSS skills training or psychotherapy or
other components that we pay for, they probably would get their services covered. But we don't pay for ABA. It's, as I said before, a package of services. It's not the procedures.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I want to thank you all for your testimony. We have a couple other people. Noor?
The question that I would like, I didn't get the answer of it. Is it a yes or no?
Yes, they cover the individual treatments. No, they don't bill for anything called ABA, as I believe, if I've, have I summarized that correctly?
So that means they cannot get that services, so I have to pull out from them from there.
No.
Madam Chair.
Would you like to describe the
sure.
percent of Haiti?
What they were saying is that the individual services that makes up ABA, DHS covers a certain amount of those. What they don't cover is a bundled service of ABA. So if you think about it, that if ABA is a bunch of different services, right, that's how I understand it. They cover, the provider can bill for the individual services, but they can't bill for the bundled services. And the reason for not being able to do that is because Medicaid, the federal government, doesn't allow them to bill for the bundled services, but providers do, as this gentleman had talked about today. The providers can bill for the individual services that make up the ABA services. So if you ask the question in a way that says, can your child get the services that make up ABA, the answer is yes. If you ask the question that says, will DHS pay for a bundled ABA, then the answer is no. That's the best way that I can explain it.
If I go back to the statement that the DHS provided up here, they say everybody gets equity and for the services that they're getting. I don't believe that we're getting the equal services that other Americans are getting, because there is no one single Somali who has a waiver, who have been just given the waiver programs. So the other thing is, this is a kind of psychology that says we pay part of it and we don't pay part of it. All the services that I have seen in there when I just visited the center, it was really something that my two children can benefit from it.
So I appreciate that. The one thing I do want to say is that they were having this hearing about the increased prevalence of autism in the Somali community. The rule that DHS gave was for everybody who is on MA, not just Somali individuals or Somali people, even though we're talking about this in the context of your community. But the idea that if you're on MA, no matter who you are, if it's me, if it's you, if it's Representative Rue, that the rules are the same no matter who you are. So if there is an equity issue, it's not an equity between who the individuals are. It is what the federal government is saying that they will pay for.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for giving me my time.
Appreciate you coming forward. I have, if I have the list in front of me, Abdullahi Farah and Noor Hale or Holly. Thank you. Would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Noor Hale.
Noor, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I'm a Somali parent with a son who is an autistic. My son is almost 9 years old, and he has not had any ABA or any effective treatment. He's still nonverbal, and I excited when I heard about the possibility that my son will be getting an ABA treatment. But what I'm hearing from the MDH is very concerning, and it's making me second guess if my son will be able to utilize that service, that treatment or not.
Could you tell us what services your child is getting now, sir?
He's what services he's getting?
Yes, now, yeah, currently.
Yeah, he's getting very limited physical and OT treatment and non-speech therapies, not at all.
No speech therapy.
No speech therapy, yeah.
And I might just mention, this is one of the issues that's come up time and again. I think we need, as a committee, to talk about how we find a resource for people who feel they're not getting services. They need a resource for people to go to. And I know when you're in the school district, you might deal with your individual school. If you're dealing with mental health treatment, I've been doing a little bit of research behind the scenes to see if we can utilize an ombudsman, which is a term that's rather confusing to me. But nonetheless, it's a person that will help people sort out their services. And I think we'd like to research this a little bit further and see if we can't identify a particular person to we call it like troubleshooting, a troubleshooter for people who aren't getting the services that they need. So I think, having heard what you've said and some of the others, I think I'm going to highlight that on my list of to-dos.
Yeah, if I may add, my son Absolutely. Has had all those OT and speech mm-hmm. and all that for a number of years, and he has not benefited any significant thing that I can tell. Last OT and speech he had at the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis, and they were told us that he was not going to benefit from it, and they discontinued. They said, you can keep your child. He's not gaining anything from out of it. So that's, and we know, and a lot of people can testify that ABA is a lot more effective than this regular in school OT or speech or anything like that. So, and my real concern is that this amendment that you guys trying to enact right now is mandating that private insurance cover ABA. It says specifically to cover ABA, and if there is going to be such a legislation that's going to mandate to cover an ABA, just the word ABA, why we cannot have an ABA covered in the state-run programs as well? Why we cannot have it as everybody else is having it? So that's our concern. If the private can have it, why we can't?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Abdullah Hafari, Farah? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Let me just interject. Were you asking that question, sir?
Yeah, the question.
I don't know if you were here when the department was talking about that issue, and that they can't bill it as ABA services. They can't do it. That the legislature had enacted a similar clause in which to do it, and after they went to the federal government and they talked about this issue, they were unable to bill it in that way. So what they are doing is that they're telling providers that they can provide many of the services that ABA provides, but they have to bill it in an individual level. And so there are people who are getting a lot of those services, not necessarily saying it's ABA, but all of the individual services that ABA provides. But it was the department that said that this wasn't something, like right now, I just want to be clear, because I think this is going round and round and round, and I'm going to look at Ida, and I really want her to be able to sit down and have this conversation instead of having you ask the same questions over and over, instead of having you ask the same questions over and over again, because I think that that's important, is that even if we wanted to do it, just one second, even if we wanted to do it, even if there's a committee, we said, yes, this is what we want to do, and we pass it, and we go all the way, and the governor signs it, what the department is saying is that the federal government, as they work out this transaction, will not allow us to bill it in that way. So I may not be explaining it as technical as, you know, as eloquent as others, but I want us to be really clear as to what the issues are. They're not around the table per se. It's the interplay between us and the federal government.
And I also want to say that I think you stated it very well, Representative Hayden, but right now we are in a time of change at the federal government, and so we don't know what tomorrow will bring, because the health care reform bill has passed. There are additional amendments being proposed almost daily. We're still watching that flesh out, and having had a town hall meeting on autism in Rochester just a few weeks ago with Congressman Waltz, many of these issues will be dealt with in the rulemaking process. And because the federal law says that pre-existing conditions will be covered, this will be one of the issues that will be discussed in rulemaking. It is, and we need to be a part of that, and I've encouraged Representative Huntley to keep in contact so that we can make certain that they change the wording and the rules at the federal level to help us here at the state level to be able to do maybe some bundle services that will address your question. But I think Representative Hayden's right. You can get the services currently. You just, they're billed as individual skills therapy, personal care services, or many, many other listed names.
So what I'd like to do is to have Idle sit down at the table and introduce yourself, and then let's talk about some of the concerns. I know that we have a couple of more, but I think that that might be important. And as part of this process, what I see happening is maybe the questions are coming from her through folks. I think it is important for you to come. I'm inviting you to the table to sit down and ask those questions. I think that that would be important.
It is helpful, and we have six other parents that want to testify. So if you all want to come forward, the six of you that are on the list, please. And I have one: Asha Ali, Muhammad Jabral, Shafi Hassi, Muhammad, and then Abdullah Hafara, and then Idle, if you would like to join them, and then we can quickly.
I'm gonna summarize at the end because I appreciate all of you, Chairman Norton and members of the committee. So at the end, I will summarize. And the reason, Representative Hayden, we keep asking this question, as DHS has said it in plain English, we do not.
So we'd like for you to state this. Your name for the record.
Okay.
So that
I
we know who you're
right
talking
now
about.
Because we're going to be coming, and okay. We have to be over.
We have
the floor.
To go. So why don't I just go, and then we'll just see. My name is Idle Abdul. I am from Somalia. I have a son with autism. Good afternoon. When I wrote this speech, it was going to be good morning.
2 to 3 minutes, please.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to thank Representative Huntley for suggesting this. And a lot of people have been saying that this is an informational. It is informational. However, when we came last time and we had a lot of concerns, apparently we were able to get the people, the members of that committee, of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, ask questions. And our question was, will Department of Human Services pay for applied behavior analysis or early intervention analysis? Now, what they have clearly said is that we pay for life skills, we pay for throw a ball, we'll pay for personal care assistance. What we're asking is our children should get the same equal access to early intervention. As you have seen now, you've seen so many people that are saying, you know, autism is happening in the Somali community. It's very high. So if we don't take care of these kids now, if we say that if you have a child with autism, you have private insurance, yes, you can charge, you could get billed as an ABA. But if you have a child with autism, you are low income. It doesn't even have to be Somalis. This is every corner of Minnesota. If you have low income, you have medical assistance, general assistance, they will not cover for that. They'll cover for CTSS contract, which is the life skills. We don't want life skills. I'm sorry. I want my kid to talk. I want my kid to be the next Huntley, the next Norton, the next Hayden. I want my kid to be just as you. My son
hopefully
is as Minnesotan. My kid is as Minnesotan as 10,000 lakes. He's as American as apple pie. He deserves the right to get equal early intervention. That's just it. When we called, when you asked, DHS, they said we don't pay. So we're asking, and that's the reason this meeting was called. I appreciate MDH coming. And sorry, I want to talk fast because I want to get in. I appreciate Minnesota Department of Health coming, and I will tell you they have been, Commissioner McNan and everybody in her staff has done such a fantastic job. The Minnesota Department of Education has done an amazing job. They've done forums on autism and Somalis. They've done workshops. They've done videos. They've done brochures. DHS, you're on my next to-do list. not so much. So we appreciate the MDH and MDE, and we're glad that elected officials are now seeing that this is a crisis. And I'm going to borrow a line that you've used, Representative Huntley, when you were at the Means and Ways Committee and you were trying to get your bill of 2614. I'm learning these things. And I think somebody had asked you, they said, this is expensive. Why are you? We don't need it. Let's cut it. And you said, if whether we pay for these children, for these people or not, they will show up at the hospitals, and hospitals in Minnesota have to take them. So it's better to get them to early. It's better to give them prevent it. We want you to help us to prevent it so that our kids can become like you. So if you say if you have low income, if you have general assistance, we're not going to do early intensive therapy. Forget this bundle, this. We don't want life skills. We want early intervention, just like the next Michael Smith. We want that. So if you're saying, let's not pay these low-income kids, they will be here. I have a country. I'll go back. My kid is going to stay here. And the cost will be staggering to Minnesota and to the United States of America.
So
thank you.
I think that is phenomenal, and we agree. We absolutely agree. And I want us to be able to have a conversation, and this is what this is about, to understand what those issues are. And I wasn't sure if you were in the room or not when they explained what happened between the bundled ABA services versus the individual pieces that make up ABA services. And we do have a couple of more testifiers, and this merits a lot more conversation. But you are right. It is an equity issue. It is a social justice issue. Mm-hmm. What I am trying to say to you is that with respect to the issues of who are on MA and who is on TEFRA and who is on PMAP and who is on private insurance, the issue is not the will of the state or the department to want to provide equitable services. It is the ability for us to be able to work with the federal government in order to make that happen and to find what are the best ways, what are the most things that we can give, how can we give all that, there's many services, and many know around here that I fight on these issues and issues of people who are on MA as much as anybody around here, and so we are pushing as hard as we can. I do want to make sure that we characterize it in the right way. We absolutely want your child and every child in the Somali community to be the best that they absolutely can be. Let me reiterate that to you. We want them to be the absolute best that they can be. And with that being said, we are working. That's what these hearings are about. That's what this understanding, that's the understanding of what we're trying to do. So I want that to be clear and on the record. I also want to be respectful of others that have come from a very long ways in order to speak today. So with that being said, I'm going to move to my good friend Muhammad Jabril. Then we also want to talk to Dr. Shire and then Dr. Van Ness. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative. I thank you so much for saying that you want any child that's born in Minnesota to get equal access to care. Now, for this bill, then, House File 359, which is now on the omnibus, it's moving around. I get that, but let me finish, please.
Well, we do need to move forward, and we are on a schedule.
We're going to get
to. I'm sorry, just a sec. Yeah. I want one person to talk at a time so that we can hear each other.
Okay.
Representative Hayden, would you please continue?
I do want to, with all due respect, we've heard a lot of testimony, and I just want us to make sure that we respect everybody who comes, including you, and we have invited you to the table, and we will continue to do that. So I want us to make sure that we are going to hear from everybody who has come. They are equally as important, and they also have things that they want to share with us. So I ask for your indulgence and your respect.
No, I understand. Thank you so very much. I just do want to answer. It'll take 30 seconds, and that is on 4.14, where Kim Norton clearly says on this bill, this ABA coverage or early intensive coverage does not benefit. It will not change anything MA is doing. If you're saying that DHS is paying for it, then let's put that language here. Let's say that it doesn't benefit, it doesn't affect this bill because Department of Human Services in Minnesota already pays for these services. That will get me off your back.
Thank you very much. I also wanted to point out, Representative Huntley put an amendment on the bill last night for a task force. Can you recall? Could you just highlight a little bit what you put on the task force?
Well, it's the task force to look at during the interim what we can do, and to the witnesses there, you need to understand that we can regulate Minnesota insurance policies, that we, the state has the authority to do that. What we can't do is regulate medical assistance, because that's a federal program. And it's clear to me what we need to do is figure out a way to organize the services that are available in a way that the federal government will approve for the medical assistance patients, and that's what this task force will be looking at.
Thank you very much. Now, if we could move on with the other testifiers. Mohammed Jabril.
Yes.
And there was someone else that was up there that I don't think we've gotten to.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Abdullah Haifara.
Yeah, I'm Mohammed Jabril. I am chair of the board, Confederation of Somali Community.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all the representatives, the task force, government agencies, and non-profit experts on autism who have given attention to the Somali plight on this this issue. It's clearly prevalent in the Somali community in Minnesota, and that's something we really discovered very recently. And probably even it's new in Minnesota and most of America, the issue of autism. So it is an emotional issue. Our experts on this issue have been the parents of the kids who have this problem. And I am really very pleased that the legislators, the lawmakers, and the communities, health professionals, are giving attention to the Somali, this dilemma of the Somali, which totally we have no knowledge or experience with it in the past. One of the perceptions that we have, and there is, you know, concerns rather, is we're very happy to hear that the initiative has been made to the federal government on this Bill 359, and suddenly we have, the concern we have is that low income, not only Somalis, but low income kids with autism were not included. And that's, you know, it comes back to the same Bill 359. And of course, we know that Minnesotans will not, nor we are concerned about it as a community, and I'm sure we are also concerned about it. So it looks like we are on the same page in terms of doing, you know, what you can to to have some influence on the federal side. And I'm very happy that that this concern came to the table. Idil is actually our leader on this issue. She has been working hard, struggling, you know, and she have met with you all, and you know, it's a big concern, not only for Somalis, but for all low-income families to get the APA services, inclusive, not just pieces. And that's the issue. And we appreciate your concern. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we have just about 5 minutes left, and so I'm very concerned about some of our other speakers. If those of you that are on the list would like to move to the table, please. We're going to run through everyone very quickly here at the end, and I apologize. We will meet again, hopefully through a task force, and we will bring these issues to the table in the future as well.
Yeah, my name is Muhammad Kali. I'm a president of Somali American Community. I just want to mention one thing. I want you to understand, really, our kids, they're suffering so badly, and we want to have equal as other kids. As you know, a lot of different ethnicity, I don't want to mention, 1 year, 2 years, they got everything they need, their kids, they got good help. So we wanted to ask you, be sure with us and help us, please. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. If you would state your name for the record, and you can give your testimony.
I think it's still morning. Good morning. My name is Abdul Shirshira. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm at the Mayo Clinic, and I'm glad that I'm here today. And I say first, thank you for the invitation for me to come here today. And when I listened parents talk about the issue, in fact, it's heartbreaking. So I would really appreciate the Department of Human Services to respect the issues the parents are making. Even though there is this ABA bundle, one should ask, you know, what parts other Somali people asking for. At least, you know, if you could try to accommodate those parts, would be really wonderful. Because when you hear their stories, I think it is really heartbreaking. So that's one thing I want to reiterate. And what I want to actually say is just a few things. I think when I listen to parents talk and when I look at the issue of late, I think we need three things, in my opinion. Number one, we need to help the kids with autism as much as we can. Number two, we need to help parents and as much as we can, because we can imagine and what they're going through. They're going through a tough time, and in terms of lack of enough sleep, proper rest, and so on and so forth. The third thing we need is actually to do proper scientific research. I'm glad that I heard about Dr. And Panko, sorry if I say your name wrong, and about the prevalence of frequency. When I listened to her talk, and yes, and ASD is on the increase, but I would have liked to actually see figures. And are we talking about like 10% to 20% and so on and so forth? What I also heard is that we learn the issue through the public health schools. That's fine. But I was wondering, where are the hospitals, clinics? Because I thought they should be the ones who could definitely diagnose the issue and could give us an exact numbers about the issue. So that should be, I think, done in my view, even though we still respect in public schools. When it comes to the issue, surely we need to start with determining either prevalence or frequency. But on the other hand, we surely need to actually investigate as to what causes autism and why are we seeing high in proportions of autism in the Somali population. The few things that could actually come to my mind in terms of understanding the issue is to actually do studies on genetic factors. Surely there should be some genetic factors. Yes, the issue of genetics is complex, but we cannot actually underestimate how important that is. We also need to look at other issues such as environment, diet, because these people actually are from totally different environment. And what we also need to look at is also vitamins. I think the study Dr. Panko mentioned in Sweden, I think I look at it, what they found, if I remember correctly, is that they associated and vitamin D deficiency, right, and in autism. If I remember correctly, I may be wrong. Right. There are also media reports out by doctors from the state, one from Fraser, one from Hennepin County Medical Center. Both they highlighted that the issue is on the increase, and they acknowledge that there are things maybe that are triggering, but they don't actually know what these factors are. So surely the way forward, we need to do research. And for us to be able to do research, we need funding. And that is where the House will be very critical. And when it comes to people who will do the research, and of course we have the Minnesota Department of Health, we have the University of Minnesota, and we also have Mayo. Surely we are full of people who can do the work. Funding is critical, and also helping kids and parents is also very, very critical. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I think I would like to segue from that wonderful little help you gave me to the University of Minnesota. We have a Dr. Essler and a Dr. Van Ness, who are, I believe, both here from the university.
Van Ness actually apologized. He contacted
me. He had to leave. Okay. Then we have Dr. Essler from the university, and maybe you could say a few words, and then we're going to have to wrap up and get over to the floor.
My name is Dr. Amy Essler. I'm a psychologist at the University of Minnesota Autism Clinic. I'm also one of the people working with Dr. Judy Panko at the Minnesota Department of Health on figuring out some of the answers to these questions through research. What I wanted to talk about, though, a little bit, we've touched on some of the difficulties with getting a diagnosis, and being that I work in our diagnostic clinic, which is considered to be one of the best in the state, I wanted to talk about some of the barriers in this bill that might increase for some families. Right now, the bill requires to get a diagnosis to lead to getting services covered by insurance. Families would need to see a minimum of four people. Currently, and that includes medical evaluation, psychological developmental testing, speech language testing, and audiology.
that is a requirement that's going to add an undue burden to a lot of families. For example, in our clinic, we do not have speech-language. We do not have a speech-language clinician. We do not have an audiologist. So, you know, our diagnostic services would no longer be adequate in reaching this criteria. And like I said, we're considered to be one of the best in the states in diagnosing children. Already, people have a hard time getting in to see us. We're one of the places that has waiting lists for 3 to 6 to 9 months for some families. So we don't want to add any sort of extra time for parents to be able to receive this diagnosis. One of the suggestions I had would be to talk about not necessarily what professionals need to be on the evaluation, but rather what areas need to be tested. So it's not that we don't want a speech-language pathologist, it's that there really aren't that many who have the expertise in autism who are knocking down our door to come and work with us. So right now we provide a lot of that testing and can interpret that, and we refer to other people as appropriate. So I can also answer any questions that you have about the diagnostic process, if there are any questions, but that was the main point I wanted to make, is that we're adding some barriers here that aren't in existence that are already burdening a difficult process for families.
I appreciate that, and perhaps we can work with the Department of Human Services as we move forward with that. Yes, Representative Root.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Are you seeing a number of Somalis in your patient population?
I don't think we are seeing as many as we'd like to see. We have a lot of paperwork required to even make an appointment with us, and I think it's a lot of paperwork that tends to discourage not just Somali families, but any family that doesn't speak English, any family that doesn't have a lot of resources to sit down and fill out a stack of paperwork. We do that because we need that information to be able to triage families, but we would like to see more Somali families than we are.
And my follow-up question was going to be then, do you have an on-staff interpreter, Somali language interpreter, or do you access one in particular that has expertise in this area in particular?
We get Somali interpreters through, I believe, Fairview, and we don't have a specific person that we request. We do have our intake materials translated, and we have the option of contacting an interpreter to sort of go over it on the phone. But again, these are a lot of, it's hard enough to get an appointment, and then to have to go through these extra hoops, I think, is not conducive.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Van Ness, I think that you have highlighted one of the issues that I wanted to kind of draw out of this discussion, and there are many. But the one is, as we start to figure out our federal reform and think about kind of how we can provide equal access to services for all children. But the other issue is that until that point, and even after that point, this issue of all of the kind of hoops and loops that people have to go through, I think that there probably is a way to kind of maybe not have to do all of them, but what I think is probably a better way, because as folks are paying for this, regardless if it's the plans or the state or whatever, one of the things we know is we want to be able to take these children through a series of diagnostic tests, mm-hmm. in order to appropriately diagnose them so that we can figure out what is the appropriate amount of service, so that not only are they getting the services right, but we are frankly getting we're getting a good value for the taxpayers' dollars. That being said, one of the things that I would like to work on as part of this task force is to think about having what I would call a navigator. We don't have to stick with that, but a group that maybe works with the department that figures out once we know we got to get kids, ID'd, but once it looks like they are identified of having maybe ASD or in that spectrum, that then they get assigned a navigator who then kind of lays out a plan and says, here's all the things that you have to do, and then helps. And I think that it would be helpful for those navigators to have the cultural competency of the groups that they're working with, not only language, but also all of the other cultural norms, so that they can help to navigate the families through that service. So hopefully at some point we get all of the services, but to the point that we negotiate with the federal government that they're getting every single, all of the services that they possibly can get so that their children and that the families are successful. I think that that is a real learning that I've taken from this hearing and something I'd really like to work on. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. And I think we do need to wrap up, but I think you raised some excellent points. I think the navigator and ombudsman idea is certainly worth looking at. Early intervention, early diagnosis, which clearly isn't happening as it should be, is listening to the ages of some of the diagnosis. It should be done many years earlier than I'm hearing happen. And I don't know if that's cultural, if it's due to the Minneapolis area. But also that brings to mind the issues, again, where Health and Human Services crosses over with education. And I think both of those groups are going to need to be brought to the table in the future discussions. I have 10 different items that I started that we need to work on in this task force as we move forward. And so I thank you all for coming, for providing us lots of food for thought. I think you will... hopefully, we'll see this stick with the bill, and if not, you have my commitment, and I think the commitment of the people at the table to continue researching this very important topic. Thank you very much for being here.